drugs, the kobold said simply. They drugged poor Finn McCool. Could not step.
Jensen said, but you just stepped with us. The drugs have worn off now, yet you're still here. Sally grinned, an expression that reminded Jensen uncomfortably of the beagles, the wolf people. Oh, he knows that if he runs, I will track him down. You won't be able to hide, will you, you little prick? Wherever you go, I will find you and kill you. The kobold shrugged. He had already seemed nervous enough.
Poor Finn McCool, he repeated.
The heat, the dryness, were sucking at Jensen's strength.
Shall we get on with this?
Good idea. Sally glanced down the dry valley at the looming stone mass of the building there. Not too healthy for any of us, hanging around that thing. Suddenly she had a ring in her hand.
This what you need, Finn McCool?
On the Beagle World, the trolls had gathered by a riverbank. Joshua and Bill walked towards them. Bill was carrying a backpack containing Lobsang's patent translation device. Every step caused Joshua precise, relentless agonies. His lower back felt hot and damp, and he wondered if his stitches were ripping open as he carried the weight of the crossbow gadget. If so, the blood loss might kill him slow, even if he didn't step to give the weapon the chance to kill him quick. Even his dodgy shoulder was hurting, a grace note added to the symphony of agony from his back. He tried to concentrate on his surroundings. The river was wide, strong, placid, and its banks were dominated by green fields and forest clumps. From the fields, the beagle's strange herd beasts had come to drink, sipping at the lapping water, lowering their misshapen heads. And the trolls were here, by the water. A band of them had gathered at the closest point of the river to the eye of the hunter, where irrigation channels and open sewers cut across the ground to the town. As always, the troll group, though sedentary in this world, was mobile in the long earth. At the fringe of the pack, scouts and hunters continually flicked away and returned like ghosts. There were hundreds of trolls in this one band. Joshua could see they had been here for some time. The ground was scuffed and muddy, and there was a strong, unmistakable troll musk in the air. There were more bands like this, Joshua could see, spread along the riverbank and on the far side and deeper into the country. The long call, unending, seemed to hang above them, a cloud of elusive memory. Surely there were still trolls out there, across the long earth. Nobody had any real idea how many trolls there were in total, but this really did look to be where they were concentrating. He could see that. The center of gravity of the troll population. And the band before him was the very pivot of it all, as far as he was concerned. For there was Mary, the runaway from the gap, and her cub, Ham, unmistakable in the remnant of the silvery spacesuit the nerds at the gap had dressed him up in. As Joshua and Bill approached, the trolls did not quite fall silent, but the volume of their song diminished. Ham sucked his thumb as he watched them, wide-eyed, apparently curious, like all young mammals. Bill slipped the pack off his shoulders and unloaded it. It contained a tablet, blank and black, a couple of feet square with a fold-out stand. Bill set this up and placed the tablet to face the trolls. Joshua glanced down. That's it? No on switch, no boot up? Bill shrugged. Black Corporation shit. It's not like the troll call translators that Sally described, by the way. Those trumpet things. Some kind of new Black Corporation shit. You figured what you're going to say here? How you're going to convince them that humanity loves them after all? Joshua had purposefully not thought this far ahead. He was no public speaker, and even preparing for town meetings back at Hell Knows Where tended to make him freeze up. I figured I'd wing it. Bill patted him on the shoulder, gingerly. Good luck with that. He stepped back. Joshua faced the trolls, standing straight, trying to ignore the liquid pain of his back. He was aware of them watching him, hundreds of pairs of those dark, unreadable eyes, backed up, he reminded himself, by hundreds of pairs of hairy arms and fists like steam hammers. and he was the representative of a humanity that was probably still treating their kind as brute beasts across a million worlds. What the hell was he going to say? He spread his hands.
Good afternoon.
Actually, it's still morning, muttered Bill.
I suppose you're wondering why I've gathered you all here today.
That's it. Start with a gag.
The trolls were motionless.
Phew! Tough crowd.
Shut up, Bill. I didn't say that, Joshua.
Joshua turned. A figure stood beside him, tall, erect, still, with shaven head in an orange robe, and with a broom in his right hand.
Labsang.
I don't mean to steal your thunder, Joshua, but I figured you could use a little backup.
You can never have too much backup, Joshua muttered.
Labsang smiled, and for an instant he flickered, shuddering into a cloud of boxy pixels. Joshua could see the green prairie through his substance, before congealing again. A hologram, then, projected from the box. Labsang took a step forward, glancing back at the translator box.
Hit it, boys!
The thrilling sound of a mass choir burst from the translator box and filled the air, a pounding, repetitive chant, a thousand voices. To Joshua's ears, it was not quite human, not quite troll, but a blend of the two. The trolls looked astonished. They stopped grooming, stood up, all their faces turned towards Labsang. And already, Joshua could hear the song of the trolls was echoing the translator's riffs. Labsang raised his arms, brandishing his broom.
My friends, you know me. I am Labsang, who you know as the Wise One. This is Joshua. They call him the Wanderer. Yea, the Wanderer. And we have travelled far to speak to you.
As he spoke, he backed up his words with rudimentary sign language, and his own voice sounded, over the chorus from the translator box, thin, high, distinctive, like a bark trumpet.
Just when I thought my life couldn't possibly get any weirder, Joshua muttered.
Bill said, I guess he can take this off around this world, speak to as many trolls as he can get to. A hologram's not going to grow tired. The Labsang World Tour 2040. The good thing is, we haven't got to listen to it every time he does it.
Sally handed Finn McCool the ring.
Show us.
Easy, said the kobold.
He took the ring between his supple finger and thumb, set it on his upturned palm, spun it. The ring blurred into the air, still spinning, shot past Jansen's face like a bright blue hornet, and made straight for the big stone building. It burrowed into the dirt at the base of the building's face, whirring like a drill bit, throwing up a spray of sand, until it had disappeared. There was stillness, silence. Sally seemed irritated. She glanced at the kobold.
Now what? Just wait.
Jansen smiled at Sally.
You okay?
Sally shook her head.
I just get annoyed by stuff like that. Magic ring crap. What a stunt. I mean, I could imagine how that could work. Miniature accelerometers to detect the spinning that activates it. Some equivalent of GPS to figure out where it has got to go. Some kind of propulsion, magnetic. Even micro-rockets of some kind. Just a dumb trick to impress the credulous. Easily distinguishable from magic.
The ground shuddered under their feet. Jansen, queasy, stepped back quickly. Sand, thrown up from the foot of the building, settled back quickly in the dry air. What looked like a kind of lizard shot across the valley floor, seeking the shelter of a heap of rocks. Above them, creatures like buzzards rose up, alarmed, cawing. There was a grinding rumble, and, to Jansen's blank astonishment, a whole section of the flat valley floor sank out of sight, down into the ground, revealing a ladder. Rungs cut into a stone wall.
Ha! Sally clapped her hands together. I knew it! Natural concentration of uranium, my butt!
The kobold came to Jansen.
Watch!
Watch what?
No!
He tapped his wrist.
Watch!
Bemused, she handed over her old police-issue timepiece. He held it up to the sunlight, trying to read its face.
8 minutes?
I knew it, Sally repeated, staring at the hole in the ground. The first time we came here, I said so. There's a nuclear pile in that pyramid or under it. It's old, old and abandoned technology, yet still hot. So old that later generations, who'd long forgotten the accomplishments of their ancestors, were attracted by the strange phenomena of the ancient waste, and were slowly killed off by it. Of course, this is the way the story was supposed to turn out. All ancient civilizations leave behind underground vaults of secret weapons, and each key works only once, I'm guessing.
Jansen's cop instinct told her there must be more to this situation than that old movie cliché. This was all supposed to be millions of years old. What possible technology could endure such a time? And why would you set up such long-duration caches anyhow? For whose benefit? The only alternative was that these caches were somehow being replenished. But who by? How? Why? The kobold was still glaring at her watch, a caricature of a timekeeper, and now wasn't the moment for speculation. Jansen turned on the kobold.
8 minutes until what, monkey boy? Until tomb seals again.
He studied the watch face, but numbers were evidently a mystery to him.
Less now?
Sally turned.
I'll go.
No.
Jansen grabbed her arm with all the strength she could muster.
You said it's radioactive in there.
Yeah, but I already bought the farm, Sally. Let me. Monica, I mean it. I feel like I owe Joshua.
She put on her determined face.
What do I have to do? Flash my badge?
Go then. Go! Go!
She actually pushed Jansen away. It seemed to wear Jansen out just crossing the dry riverbed to the hole in the ground. Was she going to be capable of doing this? What if she just got stuck down there when the kobold's 8 minutes were done? No help for that, if so. Get on with it. To her relief, the ladder cut into the wall was easy to climb down, with fat hand and footholds. Getting back out might be more problematic.
Sally, how much time?
7 minutes. Less. I don't know. Shift it, Jansen.
I'm doing my best.
At the base of the shaft, she stood in a puddle of light from above. A kind of corridor, too low for her to stand upright, led off into the blackness. Only one way to go. She carried a flashlight in her pocket, smaller than her thumb, with no iron parts, so it worked when she stepped. She was an ex-cop. She always carried a flashlight. She flicked it on now and followed a splash of light into the deeper dark. Joshua had always carried a flashlight, she recalled, even as a 13-year-old on step day. That was Joshua. This is for you, Joshua, she told herself, as she drove herself on. To hell with trolls and beagles. For you. The walls seemed to be of unpainted stone, no markings, no signs. Yet they weren't smooth. They were ridged in uncertain, uneven patterns. Tentatively, she touched the markings, let her palm run over them as she hurried deeper into the corridor. She got the sense of meaning in the markings, like the time she'd attended a cop's familiarization class on Braille. Was this the writing of the reptile folk who had built this place? Tactile, not visual.
Jansen, you might want to move your ass.
She came to a T-junction. Unbelievable. Maybe the markings gave definite directions one way or another, this way to the magic ray guns, but they were useless to her. She turned left at random, hurried down a corridor, hunching to avoid the low ceiling. Another junction. She took another left. What the hell? But remember the way back. Remember the way. The walls were broken here by what looked like storage shelves. She saw pots, boxes, heaps of what looked like clay tablets engraved. More records? Other kinds of stuff, equipment she couldn't even recognize.
Jansen!
Sally's voice was very faint now. Another T-junction. She went right, again at random, and now her flashlight picked up a ruby glint. Rack upon rack of ray guns. Lobsang apologized for the way humans, some humans, had treated trolls. He spoke of lobbies pressing the US government to grant trolls human rights, at least within the US aegis, the long footprint of America across the Earths. It was only a start. There was no way to ensure that every human everywhere would behave as decently as they should. But it was a start.
"Maybe it's the best we can offer them,"
Bill said to Joshua, speaking loudly to make himself heard.
"Kind of symbolic, but real nevertheless. Like the British Empire formally abolishing slavery in the early 19th century. Didn't get rid of slavery overnight, but it was a sea change."
"He sounds like Martin Luther King with a heavenly choir. Typical Lobsang."
"I wonder how much of this abstract stuff they can understand," Bill said.
Joshua shrugged.
"Their collective intelligence is different from ours. If they get the basic message, give us another chance, that might be enough."
"And what about giving these beagled beasts Dan Dare ray guns? Where's the morality in that?"
"Well, they're not our guns," Joshua said. "And we didn't provide them in the first place. If we live through this, there'll be other parties to follow. Proper contact. We can talk to the beagles then about peace, love, and understanding."
"Sure we can. After we've all had rabies shots." "So you think this is going to work? This whole mad stunt of Lobsang's? And what then?"
To Joshua, all his life the future had been nothing but a continual surprise.
"Tomorrow never knows."
There was a soft tap on his shoulder. He turned to look up into the cold eyes of Snowy.
"Talk to trolls? Going well?"
"I think so."
"Good. Your work done?"
"I guess."
"Joshua?"
"Yes?"
"Run."
The rock hatchway had slid back into place, and save for a patch of disturbed earth, there was no sign of the passageway into the ground. Only a heap of toy-like sci-fi blasters retrieved from the cache. Oh, and the ring, which had somehow been spat back out to lie on the ground. Jansen sat in the dirt, shivering despite the heat. Finn McCool hissed,
"Have guns? Now back to beagles, and say goodbye to Joshua?"
Sally snatched up the ring and harangued him.
"What did you mean by that, you piece of garbage?"
He backed off, hands raised defensively.
"Deal nearly finish," he said.
"Ray guns? Trollen, now payback. Granddaughter, honor Joshua. You say goodbye to him?"
Sally glanced over at Jansen.
"You any idea what he's talking about? I'm guessing nothing good."
"Gang culture," Jansen murmured, exhausted. "Like that, maybe. The honor of the warrior. She's going to grant him a good death. Maybe that's what he means."
"Shit. Then we have to help him."
Sally glanced around.
"What have we got? Think, think."
She pocketed the ring and a ray gun that she slipped inside her sleeveless traveler's jacket.
"What else? You, little Joe."
The kobold cringed.
"What? What?"
"You got your Walkman?"
"Stone that sings?"
"Give it to me."
But mine.
He sounded like a child. She grabbed his wrist so he couldn't step away without her.
"It's that, or your left bollock. Hand it over. Now we go back. Get ready to step, Jansen."
Chapter 66 Joshua backed away from Snowy, and from Bill, who scrambled to pack up the translation gear. Some instinct guided Joshua towards the riverbank, the flowing water. How the hell was he supposed to handle this? He was barely conscious as it was. The device on his back felt like a huge, malevolent crab now, digging its claws deeper into his flesh with every pace. Maybe the painkillers were wearing off. And Snowy followed. He wasn't moving as quickly as Joshua, so the gap between them opened up. Yet there was a steady, purposeful, relentless quality to his gait. Then he dropped to all fours, becoming even more wolf-like. A huge, big-brained, weapon-carrying wolf. Joshua was aware of the trolls, watching, apparently curious, but none intervened. Other dogs watched too. Lily, the Morden Brian. More warrior types followed, it seemed, come to see the show. Suddenly all the beagles howled, a pack in full cry.
"Come, Joshua," Snowy growled. "This fun."
"Get stuffed, Crypto."
"And honor for you, gift of granddaughter, life here cheap."
"Big letters."
"Many born, all die. To die well is to have lived well."
"That's your culture, not mine."
"Head high on her wall, honor of place."
"Whose head?"
"Yours."
"Thanks."
Joshua, succumbing to the inevitable, turned and started to jog, parallel to the river.
"How can I win?"
"Die well."
"Any options aside from that?"
"My head on wall. Play fair."
"What?"
"I play fair."
The beagle stopped, stock still, and closed its eyes.
"Run, human."
Joshua didn't hesitate further. He ran. He tried to think like a wolf, like a dog. Or rather, cliché scenes from every bad wolf chases man movie flashed through his head. What the hell? He dived into the river. Given this was generally such a hot, arid world, the water was surprisingly cold, the current strong, and it swept him downstream fast. Heavy in his clothes, he struggled to keep his head above the water. He considered kicking off his boots, then thought about running over open ground barefoot, and kept the boots. As long as he didn't drown, this was a good plan, right? Throw the dog off the scent, like in the movies. But the pain from the lethal gadget on his back seemed even sharper in the cold water, and he felt like it was talking to him. You could always just step away. End it in a second. A bolt through the heart. How bad can it be? Better than getting your throat bitten out by Deputy Dog back there. But he wasn't dead yet. The river soon swept him away from the cultivated country, the fields, and into rougher terrain. He'd been brought into this place unconscious and hadn't had a chance to scope it out. Evidently the Eye of the Hunter, the city of granddaughter Petra's den, really wasn't so large. He'd need to find a place to hide before Snowy caught up with him.
"Watch out!"
The voice came from downstream. He struggled to get his head out of the water. There was Snowy, sitting on a rock as if waiting to be fed by his owner, calmly watching Joshua get washed by. He yelled back,
"Watch out for what?"
Snowy glanced further downstream.
"The rapids."
And in a heartbeat, Joshua had been swept past Snowy's rock and over a low waterfall and into the rapids. He was buffeted from one boulder to the next, a punch to the kidneys here, a slam in the chest there, as he tumbled through the rocks like a piece of lumber. He forced himself to give in to the surging, turbulent flow, to keep his limbs loose, to protect his head. But every time the pack on his back caught on some projection, the pain was agonizing. Then he was through, squirted out like an orange pip from a child's lips, and he was hurled even further downstream. When he glanced back, he could see no sign of Snowy. At least he might have gained some distance. A fallen tree lay across the stream. With a mighty effort, he plunged that way, grabbed the tree as he went past, and pulled himself out of the water onto a bank of gravel. He sat up to protect his back, panting, one breath, two, three. There was nobody about. No Snowy. But now he had stopped moving, he had time to concentrate on the pain in his back, a raking, ripping, tearing anguish. Worse, his lower back felt slippery again, and the damp gravel under him was stained red with blood. Joshua Valiente had been travelling alone in the long earth since he was 13 years old. He had been in some tight spots before, and he was still around. There was no reason why he couldn't get out of this one. "And you can always step. Just step into a different sunlight, and it will be over in a flash." Not yet. Think ahead. Dogs and scent, right? He pulled at his clothing. His shirt was a ruin anyhow. It fell apart easily. He threw one half into the water and let it wash downstream, Then he draped the other half over the tree that had saved his life. He stood glancing around and started to paddle down the river, sticking close to the bank, staying in the water.
Nice try.
Snowy was right in front of him. Joshua lunged to his left, away from the river, and ran across broken turf-like ground, not grass, something similar. The fallen tree that had saved him from the river was part of a shattered copse that looked as if it had been smashed apart by a lightning strike. He dived that way, rolled into the shadow of a big fallen trunk. The huge form of the beagle padded silently across his vision. Then he heard a human voice calling from far away, a male voice singing, a thin, wailing song, something about remembering Walter. The sound seemed to trigger a reflex in Snowy, and he bounded away. Joshua knew he had been granted seconds, no more. No point running. He clambered out of his cover, his back aching, and he could feel blood trickling down his bare flesh. He cast around the clearing, picking up fallen branches, testing them. Here was one, thick and solid, too long. He smashed it in two on a lichen-covered trunk. He had a weapon. A soft growl. He turned. Snowy had the chewed-up remains of Finn McCool's Walkman in his mouth. He spat the junk to the ground. Without hesitating, Joshua whirled, swinging the branch as hard as he could. It slammed into the beagle's heavy skull. It felt as if he'd tried to brain a marble statue. The impact shattered up his arms. His aching back and even his bad shoulder hurt like hell. But the beagle stumbled, almost fell. Joshua glimpsed knives of stone and iron in the veld at Snowy's waist. One chance. He leapt forward, his fingers grasping for a blade. But Snowy stood straight, almost gracefully, almost kindly, and simply shouldered Joshua to the ground. Now Joshua was flat on his back, with the crossbow gadget digging painfully into his spine. The man-wolf was on top of him, standing easily on all fours, his paws pinning Joshua's limbs, his heavy head above him, staring down. A scent of meat on his breath, a glimpse of a wagging tail. Snowy actually licked his face.
"This won't hurt."
No, it damn well wouldn't. Joshua braced to step, to put a clean end to this. But that hadn't been Snowy's voice. He glanced sideways in sudden hope. Not a human, another dog. Lily. She said,
"Granddaughter wants trophy. You want life. All can win."
Snowy panted.
"I tell granddaughter I chewed your face off. Trophy head, useless."
Joshua gasped. "She won't be happy with that."
"So I give her another trophy."
"What other trophy?"
"Hold still."
Lily bent and closed her mouth over Joshua's left wrist. As the great jaws closed, severing skin and tendon and muscle and bone, Joshua screamed. But he did not step. Chapter 67. Geographically, Valhalla was near the coastline of the inland ocean of this distant America, on Earth West 1.4 million plus 13. Stoner miscount correction applied, as Ensign Toby Fox solemnly told Maggie. The dirigibles of Operation Prodigal Son arrived in this world about midday of a sparkling late July day, and hovered in a blue sky as pure as a special effect in a computer game. Admiral Davidson briefed his captains. They were here to assert the authority of the United States over these rebels, he said. But he wanted a show of goodwill, not a shooting match. His strategy was that a detachment of Marines would accompany a group of senior officers, to be nominated by the respective captains, in a march on City Hall. It was to be a good-natured, hearts-and-minds kind of event. However, he added, the Marines would be armed. And when Maggie heard that Captain Cutler from the Lincoln, the idiot who'd pulled a gun on Carl, was to be put in charge of this bizarre parade, she decided to nominate herself for the march. At the drop point, they formed up, 50 personnel in all, and walked through the streets of Valhalla, Through this city of Earth-West 1 million-plus change, this symbolic stronghold of the rebels of the Long Earth. At Admiral Davidson's orders, the Marines kept their weapons in sight, but with safeties on. Meanwhile, the silent dirigibles floated overhead, a menacing presence, full of watchful eyes, ready to act in a C2 role, as nodes of command and control. But it was hoped, not as weapons platforms, not today. And this hot, humid noon, Valhalla was empty. That was what they found as they walked on steadily from their mustering point. The Marines stuck to the middle of wide, empty roads, with the officers walking behind, the only sounds, their footsteps, and the calls of birds. There were a few abandoned vehicles in the empty streets, small hand-drawn carts. A couple of horses were tied up at a rail outside a Wild West-type saloon. There were even a couple of steam-powered cars neatly parked up. No sign of people anywhere. The dirigible crews reported that the picture was much the same as far as they could see from the air. Nobody at home. Maggie walked beside Joe Mackenzie. "Is it just me, Mac? Or do you feel kind of ridiculous?" The doctor said cynically, "Well, we are military. You said it yourself. This operation can't be all about getting stuck up trees. We have to do some soldier-type stuff from time to time." True enough. At least Maggie felt relatively at home in this place, which, unlike most stepwise communities, felt like an authentic American city, with its scale, its streetlights, a few elements of traffic control, even posters for concerts and dances and lectures and such, although these were mostly hand-lettered in a small-town kind of way. It was definitely a Long Earth settlement, though, with the buildings massive blocks of timber and sandstone and concrete, the roadways crude lanes of tar, the sidewalks compressed riverbed gravel. Then she heard the singing. They came to a kind of square, really just the intersection of two main drags. Here, in the shade of a shop awning, were a dozen trolls, singing some kind of song about mohawks and tea and taxes, as far as Maggie could tell. The Marines, in the van of the party, slowed to a halt and stared. Admiral Davidson and Captain Cutler had a quick conference. Then Cutler gave the order that they were to take a break. It was a reasonable position from the point of view of security. They were in the open here, but were overlooked by no tall buildings, and had a clear view in four directions down these empty streets. As the rest dumped their packs and fished out water bottles, Cutler posted sentries to each of the square's four corners, and guys with steppers were sent a world or two to either side also. It was a classic Long Earth security drill. Maggie stood on the tarmac with Mac and Nathan. Nathan dug an MRE out of his pack, a meal ready to eat, popped it, and dug into a hot beef pie. Mac looked on, seemingly faintly appalled.
"Don't know how you eat like that in a moment like this, man."
Around a mouthful of pie, Nathan said,
"Takes years of dedicated training, Doctor. You got any salt?"
"No, I don't have any salt."
Mac dug a handheld computer out of his own pack and held it up to the trolls.
"I'm trying to identify that song they're singing." "Aha! Bring in your axes and tell King George we'll pay no taxes on his foreign tea. It's a Revolutionary War ballad, the Boston Tea Party. Whoever taught the trolls that is sending us a message, and has a sense of humor."
Nathan said, finishing up his MRE,
"But where the hell is everybody else?"
Mac said,
"I'm guessing in other parts of the city."
"What other parts?"
"Oh."
Mac was pointing at random, his fingers cocked at funny angles.
"Stepwise," Maggie said. "They've all gone stepwise."
"Kind of. I visited once. This city actually extends stepwise in a way. I mean, it's not like a low earth footprint of a datum town like New York West 1 or East 5 or whatever. Here, the other worlds are more or less unspoiled, and therefore full of stuff to hunt and gather and eat. People live out there at least some of the time. Together they support the city at the center. It is kind of quiet today, isn't it? Usually there's some sort of critical mass of people actually here."
"But not today."
"Not today. Well, I guess they knew this invasion force was on the way. Who wants trouble? But not much of a war, is it, if nobody's interested in fighting? Not much fun.
Captain Cutler heard that, and turned, glowering.
Fun, officer?
Sure, sir, Max said with a grin. War is fun. That's the terrible secret. Why, we've been doing it back to the Bronze Age, if not before. Well, now we have the Long Earth. Everybody can have as much as they possibly want. There's always room to just walk away. No more need for war, right? Maybe it's a phase we need to grow out of.
Nathan raised his eyebrows.
Good luck with that as a guide to your career progression in the Navy, Doctor.
A whistle blew. The break was over. Time to continue their march. The Marines began to pack up their kit, and sentries flicked away to summon back their buddies from their stepwise posts. The City Hall, according to the maps they had, was only a couple of blocks north of here. Soon Maggie could see it, up ahead, over the shoulders of her officers. It was a squat, colonial-era mansion kind of structure, sitting on a bluff, a scrap of high ground. An open square sprawled before it, another road intersection. Two big flags fluttered from poles high above the building's frontage. One was the Stars and Stripes, the other was a blue field, covered with a string of cloud-blue discs. Mac grunted,
I wondered when we get to see that new flag. There's a bunch of rebel colonies scattered across the Earths, starting with New Scarsdale back around West 100,000, and working their way all the way up to Valhalla and beyond. They're the ones who backed the Footprint Congress here at Valhalla, where they composed their Declaration of Independence, and that's their flag. Multiple worlds, see?
Maggie heard a series of soft pops, like bubbles bursting. People stepping in. At last they had company. Cutler started barking orders, relayed by the Marine commanders. The marching formation broke up into a line. Maggie took her own position. And she glimpsed people, men, women, children, most dressed either like farmers or beach bums, or a combination of the two, just popping into the world, all over the square before the City Hall. They arrived sitting down, and when one landed on top of another, the newcomer would fall away, laughing and apologizing. A babble of conversation started up, like a country fair. All these people were filling in the space between the Marines and the City Hall. The dirigibles patrolled overhead, observing, impotent, their turbines growling. Captain Cutler, red-faced, surveyed this scene.
Bayonets!
He snapped.
Belay that, said Admiral Davidson mildly, but clearly enough for all to hear. We're here to win hearts, Captain, not to cut them out of warm bodies. And there'll be no firing either, except on my direct order. Is that clear?
And still the people kept coming, filling in the square, like human raindrops covering the ground. Some brought picnic baskets, Maggie saw, bemused. Cake, bottles of beer, lemonade for the kids. Others carried gifts, baskets of apples, even strings of big, plump-looking fish that they tried to hand to the Marines and dumped to their feet when they refused. Captain Cutler pressed Admiral Davidson.
Our mission is to take that City Hall and raise the U.S. flag, sir.
Well, it rather looks as if Old Glory is already flying.
But it's the symbolism of the act. Let me try at least to clear a path across this square, Admiral.
Oh, very well, Cutler. But play nice, will you?
At Cutler's barked orders, Marines were sent into the crowd. Meanwhile, the dirigibles began gliding over the square, loud hailers broadcasting orders.
You are asked to disperse. Disperse immediately.
Maggie watched Marine Jennifer Wang, from the detail that had travelled on board the Franklin, wade in with her colleagues. Surrounded by these people in their country work-type clothes, encased in her capot and turtle-shell body armor plates, she looked like some kind of alien invader, beamed down from the sky. Wang chose her target at random.
Move, please, ma'am,
she said to one 40-ish woman with a gaggle of kids.
I will not,
the woman said clearly. Her kids took it up like a playground chant.
I will not. I will not.
Wang just stood there, baffled. They tried lifting people bodily out of the way, grabbing wrists and ankles and just lifting. But others, especially little kids, would come and sit on the person you were trying to shift. And even if you got a clean lift, the person would just go limp, like a floppy mannequin, making him or her almost impossible to handle. Cutler, without referring back to Davidson, tried getting his Marines to soft-cuff a few of the protesters, but the people involved would just flick away into another world and come tumbling back where you couldn't reach them. Maggie found herself impressed with the coordination of this flash mob, blocking the square, with the training they'd evidently had in this passive resistance stuff, with their determination and discipline, almost military class, though with different techniques and objectives. And gradually, the chanting was breaking out all over.
I will not! I will not!
Cutler stormed back to Davidson, frustrated, angry. Maggie thought that his right hand hovered a little dangerously near his pistol. He said to Davidson,
If we could identify the leaders, sir.
With a mob like this, there may not be any leaders, Captain.
Then a couple of rounds above their heads, just to scatter them.
Without replying, the Admiral removed his cap, closed his eyes, and raised his lined face to the late summer sun. Cutler snapped,
No? Then how the hell are we going to fulfill our mission here, sir?
That last syllable was almost a snarl, and Maggie thought Cutler had to be close to insubordination, if not to breaking down altogether.
We cannot let these people mock us, sir. They do not understand us.
Understand us, Captain?
Admiral, they have never met anybody like us. Sir, you and I have served. We have been to the front line. We have taken fire. We have followed orders, and we have not yielded. And because of that, these people were able to raise their kids and come out to these dumb log cabin type of worlds and play at being brave pioneers.
Admiral Davidson sighed.
Well, the world has evidently changed around the two of us, son. In my view, the best kind of war is one that's resolved without a shot being fired. Keep your weapon holstered, Captain.
Sir!
I said, keep it holstered.
And now a man stood up in the heart of the crowd and walked towards the officers. He was maybe 60, portly, dressed as a farm laborer like the rest. Nathan murmured,
I recognize that guy.
So did Maggie. He was the guy with the favors from the community called Reboot. Maybe now wasn't the time to wave and say hi, she suspected. The man faced Davidson confidently.
Fulfilling your mission all depends what that mission is, doesn't it, Admiral Davidson? If you're here to talk, well, that's fine. I very much doubt if you're going to achieve anything else today, don't you?
Davidson eyed him.
And you are?
Green, Jack Green. I helped found a town called Reboot. Now I work for Benjamin Keyes, mayor of Valhalla.
He held out his hand. Davidson shook it, to an ironic cheer from the crowd.
If you want to talk, why don't you and your staff come to the mayor's office? I'm sure your Marines will be looked after out here. You can see the picnickers have brought plenty for everyone.
He led Davidson away. Captain Cutler, visibly livid, just stomped away off into a side street. Nathan glanced at Maggie.
With your permission, Captain, I'll go keep an eye on Captain Cutler. Make sure he doesn't do anything stupid.
Good idea.
Nathan hurried away. Mac stood with Maggie.
Ed Cutler needs therapy.
Maggie thought that over.
So will a lot of us, if you're right the war has suddenly become obsolete.
I'm right, though, aren't I?
You usually are, Mac. You usually are.
The shadow of a military specification airship passed over the crowd. People looked up, shielding their eyes against the sun.
Ooh, they said, as though it were an advertising stunt at a football match. Ah!
That was when Maggie knew the mission of the Benjamin Franklin was complete, that her own future was to fly the Neil Armstrong II into stepwise worlds unknown, that, for better or worse, without a shot being fired, the long war was over. Chapter 68. At the beginning of September 2040, with the military mission against Valhalla formally abandoned, and the trolls starting to show up in numbers again across the long Earth, Lobsang and Agnes announced they would be hosting a garden party in the Trans-Earth facility that Lobsang had turned into his reserve for studying trolls, a park spread several Westworlds deep around Madison. At first, Monica Jansen demurred, but Agnes came to see her in person in Jansen's West 5 convalescent facility.
"Oh, you must come," Agnes said. "Wouldn't be the same without you. You were involved in the great adventure with those dark people, weren't you? And after all, you are Joshua's oldest friend from outside the home."
Jansen laughed at that.
"Really? I was a gay junior cop busily making screwed-up career choices. Poor kid, if I'm all he had. Look, sister, the journey's finished me off with all that stepping and the drugs. And the dose of radiation you took in that dinosaur temple, or whatever it was, to spare Sally Lindsay," Agnes said sternly. "She told me all about that. Look, Monica, you won't have to step anywhere. Not once we've got you to West 11, anyhow. I've had Lobsang set up a nice little summer house there, and it's yours as long as you need it."
She leaned forward confidentially, and Jansen saw how her skin, supposedly of a 30-year-old, according to Lobsang, was just a little too youthful, a little too free of blemishes to be convincing. The young engineers who created such receptacles were never good at getting the flaws of age just right, she reflected. Agnes went on.
"I never could see the appeal of stepping myself, you know. Tried it once. Well, with the famous Joshua Valiente rattling around the home, I could hardly not, could I? All I saw was a bunch of trees, and my own shoes that I was trying not to puke up all over. And no people. And where's the fun in that? And now, when I step, well, I don't feel anything at all. Lobsang designed me that way, the idiot. Anyway, I can't see the point. Give me my Harley and an open road any day. Lieutenant Jansen, you must come. You're a guest of honor. That's an order."
So came the day, Saturday, September the 8th, 2040. About 2 in the afternoon, and thankfully it was a bright, sunny, early autumn day here in Madison, West 11, Jansen emerged somewhat shyly from the summer house Agnes had promised, which had turned out to be a decent little cabin with all mod cons. This location was on a height, and she had a fine view of grassy swards, dense clumps of trees, and patches of prairie flowers rolling down to the lake water. Agnes's barbecue party was scattered over this landscape, a few dozen people walking to and fro, kids and dogs playing noisily, and a knot of folk centered around a plume of rising white smoke over what was presumably the barbecue grill. A wash of music rose up from a knot of trolls down by the water, an elusive melody she couldn't quite place. Just for a moment, Jansen had a flash of disorientation, as if she saw the people as naked as the trolls, just a bunch of humanoids rolling around on this big lawn, empty-headed as young chimps, trolls, elves, kobolds. She remembered the kobold who had called himself a human name, Finn McCool, wearing bits of clothing like a human, a man, and sunglasses, and how he'd gabble when Sally and Jansen were trying to sleep. Just nonsense, but he tried to copy the rhythms of their talk. Now, sometimes, when she listened to some politician speechify on TV, or a priest yakking about God, all she saw was a kobold up on his hind legs, prattling nonsense, just the way McCool used to. Elves gone wrong. That was what Petra called humans. She shook her head. Put it aside, she told herself. She walked forward determinedly, her exposed skin slopped with protective cream, a hat covering the increasingly patchy hair on her head, her gait as ramrod straight as she could make it. She hadn't gone a dozen yards before Sister Agnes herself caught up with her, trailed by a couple of other nuns, one elderly, one maybe in her late 30s.
"Monica, thank you for joining us. These are my colleagues, Sister Georgina, Sister John."
Sister John looked faintly familiar to Jansen.
"Don't I know you?"
The nun smiled.
"My birth name is Sarah Ann Coates. I was at the home, I mean a resident. When I grew up, well, I came back."
Sarah Ann Coates, now Jansen remembered the face of a 12- or 13-year-old, scared, self-conscious, staring out of the file she had assembled on the incidents of Step Day in Madison. Sarah, one of the home children Joshua Valiente had rescued in those frantic hours when the doors of the long earth had first creaked open.
"It's nice to see you again, sister."
"Come this way." Sister Agnes linked her arm through Jansen's, and they started walking slowly towards the smoke from the grill.
"You're a great hostess, Agnes," Jansen said, only slightly sarcastically. "Are these people here and you swoop down on me as soon as I show my face? Call it a gift, but don't repeat that to Lapsang. He keeps badgering me to have avatars made, iterations like him, copies of myself running around. Imagine how much I'd get done, so he says. Imagine the arguments I'd have, me, myself, and I. So I say, I don't think so. Now then, Monica, I've assigned Georgina and John to look after you today. Anything you need, you just ask them. And any time you feel like disappearing, that's fine too."
Jansen suppressed a sigh. Deny it as she might, she knew she needed the help.
"Thank you. I appreciate that very much."
The song of the trolls carried on the shifting gentle breeze. The usual troll music, a human tune simply harmonized and turned into a round, with the melody line repeated and overlapping.
"What is that?"
"The Wearing of the Green," Agnes said. "An old Jacobite marching song. Scottish rebels, you know?"
"You can blame Sister Simplicity for that one. She always was one for her Scottish roots. That and prize fights on TV. It is good to have the trolls back, though, isn't it? Of course, we had to restrict the guest list today to make sure there weren't too many people for the trolls to cope with, and Senator Starling has promised to put in an appearance later on. Suddenly a supporter of the troll cause. And suddenly he always was, if you know what I mean. Says he sings in a Sunday choir and wants to sing along with the trolls if he can. Going to bring along a squad of Operation Prodigal Son sailors, too. The USS Benjamin Franklin Choir. Just as a gesture of peace and harmony. Now then, let's find Joshua for you. It won't be hard. He'll be close to little Dan, and Dan will be close to the food."
Agnes had appointed Lobsang as head chef. Jansen stared, bemused, at a Tibetan monk with a greasy apron over his orange robe and a chef's hat on his shaven head. A man she didn't know stood beside him, tall, 50-ish, black, in a sober charcoal suit, wearing a cleric's collar. Lobsang raised a greasy spatula.
"Lieutenant Jansen, good to see you."
Agnes more or less snarled at him.
"That soya burger is raw, and that corn sausage is on fire. Less blue skying and more fat frying, Lobsang."
"Yes, dear," he said wearily.
"Don't worry, Lobsang," said the cleric beside Lobsang. "I'll help. I'm a dab hand at chopping onions."
"Thank you, Nelson."
"Lieutenant Jansen?"
Jansen turned. Joshua Valiente stood before her, looking uncomfortable in a kind of smart casual get-up. Clean shirt, pressed jeans, leather shoes. He held his left arm to his chest, his clenched fist concealed by his shirt cuff. At his side was Helen, his wife, sturdy, pretty, cheerful. And little Dan ran past, dressed in a cut-down Twain pilot uniform, engaged in some noisy game with other kids, as oblivious of the adults and their society as if they were nothing but tall trees. Jansen and Joshua stood there, facing each other awkwardly. Jansen felt an uncomfortable surge of emotion, having witnessed the dangers to which Joshua had exposed himself so far from home, and now seeing him like this, with his family, with Helen looking as if she belonged nowhere but at his side. After all she'd been through with this man, Jensen didn't know what to say. Joshua smiled gently.
It's okay, Lieutenant.
For heaven's sake, Helen snapped. Give each other a hug.
They leaned together, and she held him tight.
With them, you're healed, she murmured in his ear. Don't leave them again, whoever comes calling.
Understood, Jensen.
And yet she knew that was a promise he could never keep. She felt a stab of heartache for Joshua, the lonely boy she had known, the lonely man he would always be. She pulled away.
Enough. Squeeze too hard and I might break.
Me too.
Joshua reached forward with his left arm, revealing his artificial hand. It was a clunky, oversized creation, with unconvincing, pinkish skin. It whirred and whined like a movie prop when he unclenched his fingers.
Bill Chambers calls it Fing, like the Adams family, you know? Funny guy. He's around somewhere, incidentally, getting smashed with Thomas Kyangu.
Jensen tried not to laugh.
Joshua, surely they could have done better for you than that. Prosthetics these days.
Helen said,
he insists on wearing that horrible old antique.
Sooner this than one of the Black Corporation gadgets Lobsang offered me.
Ah, Jensen said, with Lobsang inside.
You see the problem. I don't want to walk around with Lobsang in control of any of my extremities. I'd rather wait, thanks. Anyhow, it doesn't bother Dan, so that's the main thing.
Jensen said,
strange to think your own hand is nailed to the wall of that Beagle Princess's palace, a million worlds away.
Yeah.
Joshua glanced around, making sure Dan wasn't close by.
You never got to see that, did you, Monica? There's a bit of the story you never heard.
He likes bragging about this, Helen said wearily.
You know those two beagles had got me pinned down, Snowy and Lily. I saw they were trying to save my life in their way, but I wasn't exactly happy at losing a hand even so, and as Lily got her teeth into my wrist, I made a gesture.
He held up his robot hand, clenching a fist, and the middle finger extended with a whir of hydraulics.
And that is what is up on Petra's wall right now.
Jensen snorted laughter.
And that, Helen said wearily, is what I can't stop Dan running around doing to all his little friends every time his father tells that story.
Joshua winked at Jensen.
He'll grow out of it. Price worth paying, right?
Jensen just smiled neutrally. An experienced cop knew better than to get involved in family arguments. They were distracted by the approach of a short, slim, wiry-looking man in his 50s. He looked vaguely familiar to Jensen. Somewhat shyly, he all but stood to attention as he addressed Joshua.
Excuse me, sir. You're Joshua Valiente, right?
Guilty as charged.
Sorry to trouble you. I don't know anybody here, and I recognized your face. I'm looking for Sally Lindsay. I believe you know her.
Sure. And you are?
The man offered his hand.
Wood. Frank Wood. USAF. Long retired. Once of NASA.
There was a comedy moment. Wood had put forward his left hand to shake, but recoiled when Joshua's elderly cybernetic claw was produced in response. Jensen snapped her fingers.
I thought I recognized you, Mr. Wood. I met you at the Gap. I was up there with Sally myself.
He seemed startled to see her, then pleased. Evidently, he hadn't recognized her through the increased decrepitude of her illness.
Lieutenant Jensen, good to see you again.
More handshakes. Wood's hand was dry, firm. Jensen remembered awkwardly how she suspected this poor guy had had a crush on her out of the Gap. Helen said, a tad reluctantly,
I think Sally is down there, near the big group of trolls, with some happy landings types.
She led the way. Jensen followed, accompanied by Frank Wood. When he saw how slowly and stiffly she walked now, he discreetly offered her his arm. Just as discreetly, she smiled her thanks. She said,
Frank, just so you know,
I heard you were ill.
It's not that.
I'm gay, Frank. And ill. Ill and gay.
He took that with a self-deprecating grin. So our budding romance is doomed, huh? My radar never was too reliable. Probably why I never married.
Sorry about that.